So this talk, I unfortunately had to miss the first couple of days, but I heard that the talks were wonderful. Today's talks were also wonderful and incredibly impressive, and I can't do anything like that. But but my personality isn't quite suited for that anyway. And the reason is that, for example, Stephen today was reveling in diversity, and I revel in simplicity, where he tries to find out everything about something. I want to ignore as much as I can and find out just a little bit. And so my talk is going to be on principles that govern neural circuits, not how any specific neural circuit is governed. Just a tiny bit of background. What I do these days is I ask the question, take a step back. In order for organisms to work, and in fact, in order for evolution to work, you have to be able, neural circuits have to have a scalable architecture. You have to be able to make them bigger and be more powerful without actually redesigning them. And so what I do these days is to try to learn the design principles that endow neural circuits with a scalable architecture. And what I'm going to be talking about today is one specific subset of that problem, which has to do with the a simpler way of looking at axon and dendritic arbors. So the first thing I want to do is go back and do what Steve did and talk a little bit historically about how people have looked at arbors. And there are two starkly opposing ways. And one way is detail. So what you see up here is the an axonal arbor from a fish retinotopic a fish arbor projecting from the retina to the tectum, a retinotectal arbor. And you can see that it has lots of branches around like this. And in the detailed way of looking at these, what you do is you look at the branch length. You look at the number of branches. You look at the branch angles. And all the details that you can think of about that. And the underlying idea behind that is that the brain is incredibly precise, and that if you have an arbor right here, that it matters that this branch is right where it is to make the right synapses. That every little detail is important because this particular axon wanted to make a synapse at that particular location. And that may even be true in certain cases, maybe lots of cases, I don't know. The fact that there are a billion synapses per microliter, and there are quite a few microliters in the brain, seems to make it more unlikely that you actually would be able to, you would want to care where every single synapse is. The general point of view is that it doesn't matter exactly where the branches are. What matters is the chances that if you touch the brain at a particular point, you're going to be close enough to make a synapse with a particular arbor there. And this general way says that it doesn't matter what this thing is here exactly, that you could move this branch and put it over there. It really wouldn't make much difference. What really matters is is kind of a smeared out version of this, so you'd know what the probability, sort of like a probability density of knowing where the arbor is. According to this point of view, you have dendrite, you have a map. Most areas of the brain have a map of something in them. That map receives information from a bunch of axons. So axon arbors spread information over a map, and dendritic arbors sample information in the map, and they basically do it, according to this view, probabilistically. And so if you know what the what the probability of an axon and a dendrite being close to each other, and if you know what their type is, which is what Anirvan talked about this morning, then you would know what the neural circuit was going to be. If you just knew where all these branches, where all these arbors were distributed, what ones like to connect with some probability to other ones, then that would tell you exactly what the neural circuit is. This way of looking at it could be called looking at it in terms of the arbor density function. And I have drawn an arbor density function over this arbor here. What I did is I put a grid, 6x6 grid over this, and then in every box I added up the length of the arbor inside, because these particular fish axons we know make synapses in proportion to the length. Their connections in proportion to the length. And so this is an arbor density function. So now let me tell you what my final conclusions are going to be. And then the rest of the hour and whatever it is, 15 minutes that's left, what I'll do is try to tell you why I made these conclusions. Okay, the first part is that arbors, the density function of arbors is described by a Gaussian. Described by a Gaussian truncated at right around 2 standard deviations out from the center. Well, the first thing you say is, well, it can't possibly be. And you could be right, but these arbors aren't all a circular Gaussian. The idea is that the Gaussian is going to be stretched in one way, compressed in another, stretched in another one possibly. And so the different shapes of arbors are still, I claim, described by a Gaussian, but the Gaussian is distorted. Let me say what an arbor is also. Here is one of the layer 5B pyramidal cells that Stephen showed you. Okay, in this particular case, this would be a basal arbor, or a basal arbor, the stuff sticking out the bottom. This straight thing here, it depends on how you look at it, wouldn't be counted as an arbor, but this would be counted as an arbor up there, and this would be counted as an arbor there, but over here it wouldn't be. So the arbor is just the ramification of either dendrites or axons. And let me reiterate, there are two general kinds of arbors. There are the axon arbors, like this one, that are distributing information in the map, and there are dendritic arbors that are sampling that information. Okay, so the first conclusion is that all arbors that we've seen can be described by a Gaussian truncated at about 2 standard deviations. The second conclusion is an elaboration of this. The second conclusion is something that I'm going to tell you part of, because the second part is what I'm going to be working on while I'm here on the days we don't have talks. And that is to derive why you get a Gaussian from the properties of the individual branches. What properties do branches have to have in order to guarantee that you always have a Gaussian? And so the second part of the talk is that there are three properties of branches that guarantee you a Gaussian. These three properties are only true for arbors in two dimension that I looked at. They can't be true in three dimensions. And the problem, and the first thing that has to be done is I have to write some computer programs to do the analysis on three-dimensional arbors to find out what the corresponding properties are. I have ideas about it, but I haven't done that yet. So I'm going to show you for two-dimensional arbors, like retinotectal arbors or retinal ganglion cell arbors. I'm going to show you what the three properties are that give you a Gaussian and guarantee a Gaussian, and then I'll explain a little bit about what has to be done to get the 3D arbors, and part of it's just gathering data. Okay, so I forgot to do this, and that is that as you've probably already figured out, this is not, like Stephen's, a beautifully choreographed talk, and it won't make any difference if you interrupt me and argue with me or make comments as we go along. So I invite questions. Yes?
It sounds like it's a goal to get Gaussian distributed arbors.
No, that was not the goal. But the first part is going to be saying why I believe it's a Gaussian, and then the second part is to say, given that the arbor density function, this sort of probability-like thing, is a Gaussian, how does that arise from the branching properties? Yes.
The people at my lab are very often measuring dendritic complexity indexes, these DCIs,
yes.
And shoal analysis, where they draw like little kind of circles.
Yeah.
What is the relation to that, and does that make any sense according to you to measure these things?
So what your lab would be doing is measuring details about the arbors, right? And so I'll tell you how the details of two-dimensional arbors are related to the arbor density function. Yes.
So if you have a probability density function of x on one over space. So your claim is that higher order moments don't really play in?
What I'm claiming is that the first two moments, well, the mean and the variance tell you everything. Yeah, that's what I'm claiming. It may or may not be true, right? We'll see. Okay. The first question is, how do you measure an arbor density function? By the way, an arbor density function is not really a probability density. It's proportional to a probability density. It's not normalized, and it is. And the thing you would have to normalize it by is the total length of the arbor. So if you integrate underneath this thing right here, you get out a number, and that number is the same as if you measured all the lengths here and added them up. Okay, how do you measure an arbor density function? Well, I just did it here, and that's fine. You put a grid down on top of the arbor, and you add up the amount of branches in each one. Trouble is that this grid is so crude, is so coarse, that you can't really even compare arbors very well with it. And so you have to be able to have better resolution than 6 by 6, for a whole arbor. What people usually do in this case is they make a finer grid. Trouble is that the arbor is sparse. There's a lot of holes in here. And if you make a finer grid, then it's all so jiggly, and so there's so much noise in it, you can't see anything. Well, what people usually do when they're faced with that is they average across arbors. So you get a whole bunch of arbors and average across them, but we don't know how to do that because we don't know which arbors it's legitimate to average across, number one. And number two, we don't know what rules we should follow to orient the arbors and scale them, because that's making assumptions about the arbors that we don't have any, that aren't justified. So the straightforward way of measuring this arbor density function just won't work. What does work is what was suggested back here, and that is that there are two ways of describing a probability density function. One way is to say what the function is. The second way is to say what all its moments are. What's good about moments is that they, unlike this density here, are not local function, are things not with a local property, but they're global. And in order to have, and the moments are global characterization. The position of everything in here goes into the zeroth moment, which is the total length. The standard deviation, it has to do with how broad this, how wide this is scattered across there, how stretched out it is. And the standard deviations, if you calculate, treat that like a probability, look at the density and get the standard deviation of it, then that would give you the standard deviation you got would depend on the position of all of the parts of the arbor, not just any one part. So what's good about moments is that they are a global measure. And so what we did, and we is Joe Snyder, who was a postdoc and has moved on now, and Andrea Pillai, who was a graduate student from one of the other labs that I borrowed for a while. The three of us did what I'm talking about. And if you want to look at it in more detail, it came out maybe 3 or 4 months ago in Neuron. As far as I know, no one has ever read it, so you could be the first. Okay, how is a moment described? Here is a bit of an arbor, and what you do, either axonal or dendritic, what you do with this arbor is you digitize it by hand in a dumb way using NeuroLucida. And what that means is that you approximate it by a whole bunch of straight line segments. And so if you have a segment here, that segment has an x and a y at the beginning position, and an x and a y at the end. And so you can characterize this arbor by its length, and I'll call this is the kth branch or the kth segment. The kth segment, and so there's a weight associated with the kth segment, that's its length. So W sub k is the mass or the length of that particular segment, and there is a x and a y coordinate of the middle of it, and these branches, these segments, are all very short. So just doing it by the middle is a pretty good representation. And so the kth moment, which I call m sub k, is equal to the sum over all j, there are j branches total, of x sub k, y sub k. That is the center of the kth moment. J and j. That's the product of the x and y position of the center of the jth branch raised to the kth power and weighted by the length of the jth segment. And I didn't do this very well, so I'm going to change all these to j. This is the jth segment, and k is the moment. Okay, that is non-normalized. So if is equal to zero, you you average, you add up all the lengths. That's the zeroth moment. If k equals 2, then this is the product moment for the that corresponds to the standard deviation. And you could also have this be mkx, for example, for the in the x direction, and that would be the sum over j of xj to the kth power times w sub j. That would be the kth moment in the x direction. I'm doing everything with just two dimensions here, but we did it both with 2 and 3, as you'll see. Okay, let me say one more thing about the x's and y's. There has to be a center to the coordinate system, and the center we select for the coordinate system is the center of mass. And so these things in mechanics would be the moment would be the radius of gyration. And these things are all, you can also calculate the, if you had a piece of metal, the if you had a metal arbor and you hung a string on it, at the center of mass it would stay just balanced, and then that would be the center of mass, and then the second moment would be the radius of gyration, which would be the same as this with k equal 2. Okay. So is it okay how we measure the moments? Whether you don't know if they're useful or not, but I mean it's just a straightforward straightforward measurement of it. Okay. if you know all these moments, then you know everything there is to know about the arbor. And are the moments useful? And I'm going to show you here a reason for thinking they're useful. If you divide sigma sub k is equal to m sub k divided by m sub 0. This is the normalized kth moment. This is the unnormalized kth moment. If you add these all up, then they add to 1. And so one way measuring the of checking to see if this makes sense at all is to plot the logarithm of the product of the x and y's, and it turns out that the product this moment here at m sub k is very close to being equal to m sub k x and m sub k y. M sub k x is the moment that you calculate by just using x in here. M superscript y is what you get if you have just y to the kth power. And it turns out that the product of these two things is very close to equal to the moment of the products. The average of x and y to the kth power is very close to the average of x times the average of y to the kth power. Okay, so what this is up here, this is data from a bunch of fish retinal ganglion cell arbors and a bunch of fish retinotectal arbors, a dendritic arbor and an axonal arbor. And the conventional way of measuring, yeah.
Sir, when you wrote that as a product in that way, did you mean that, that all of your arbors were circularly symmetric?
No, doesn't matter.
Did they factorize in some?
What it means is that the function that describes them is not exactly that, but very close to that, and it's a separable function.
Right.
And there's one circularly symmetrical function that's separable, which is in Cartesian coordinates, which is a Gaussian. But so that's one of the reasons for suspecting they were a Gaussian, because they're so close to separable. And when I start talking about what we're going to do with these things, I'll tell you what our motivation was in a second. Yeah.
So, but I mean, there would be examples that are maybe not realistic for a dendritic arbor that would violate that, like if you had, I don't know, like an X-shaped arbor,
oh,
or
yeah,
a circle or something.
Oh yeah. No, it's easy to make counterexamples to show that this is not something that has to be true for everything. It's just experimentally true for the arbors. I didn't put the thing in showing separability, but you can look in the paper or take my word for it. Okay, so the log of sigma x times sigma y is the product of the standard deviation in the x direction and the standard deviation in the y direction. That's kind of an area. And the traditional way of measuring the area of these two-dimensional arbors is to draw lines around like that to make a polyhedron, a convex polyhedron that touches all the tips. It's called the convex hull. And that's the standard way of measuring them. And if you measure them any other way at all, you get as the size, the area, you get about the same thing. And the circles up here are retinal ganglion cell convex hull on the log plot versus the product of these two moments, and the slope of that line on there is 1. What that means is that, and you can't quite see them for some reason I don't understand, but there are also squares up there that are very light. They didn't quite render with the projector. And those are axonal arbors. Okay, so both axons and dendrites, the second moment at least is a valid measure of the area. And so, yes?
You're saying that the arbors are isotropic in the XY plane?
No, they're not. They're ellipses. Most of them are elliptical.
Okay, so I'm just trying to say, so where's the coefficient describing kind of the cross term? It should be like in a variance, the covariance in X and in Y, and
Okay. So what we did, I didn't say it, but what we did is we took all of these arbors and we rotated them.
I see.
So that the covariance term vanished as close as we could get it, and it always just about did.
Already in principle
coordinate. Yeah, yeah.
And so there is an isotropy.
Yes, there is. Most of the arbors, many of them are round, but most of them are kind of oblong.
Do you happen to notice, is the anisotropy, random over multiple arbors, or is it, does it ever look polarized?
So these arbors tile the retina. There are about a dozen types of retinal ganglion cells. They tile like this, but sometimes one isn't quite round, and then the ones around it are not quite round, so that it covers best. Okay, so now we have what I claim to be a reasonable description of arbors in terms of moments, so that we can compare individual arbors without having to average anything. Every arbor, what Joe and I did is calculate the first 20 moments, quite a few moments, and the limit on that was that some of the values of some of these moments are kind of astronomical numbers. They're like 10 to the 50th, 10 to the 70th power. And we were just worried about calculating more moments because they were going to be getting so big we had to worry about rounding errors and stuff like that. Besides, 20 moments ought to be fine. Roughly speaking, if you calculate 20 moments, that means that you have resolution equal to about 1/20th of the scale of the arbor. Okay, so now we have a way of describing the arbors with a bunch of numbers that characterize their arbor density function, and we did a preliminary check to show that it's sensible in a certain way. Now, what do you do with this? There's no automatic way to say what you do with something like this. You have to think about it. And what we did is we tried to think of what would make things the easiest. What would make things the easiest were, number one, are the arbors separable? What that would mean is, here is a round arbor, and you have axons growing at it from this direction, and you have axons growing at it from that direction. But now you want to sample along a line, and so you take this arbor and you elongate it like that. So, but now the axons that are growing this way nothing changes, it's the same, whereas the axons growing this way see a much broader arbor. So you would like to have it be separable so that you can change, you can stretch it in one direction and not have the stretch in that direction influence the way it looks from the other direction. And the reason you'd like that is because you don't want these axons that are trying to make contacts, you don't want them to have to be worrying about details about, well, how much was it stretched the other way. You'd like to have them say, just go ahead, and you can always count on what you're going to get. So the first thing we did is we looked at separability, and I'm not going to talk about that, because this is just the preliminary part of the talk. So the second thing you'd want is, what would be the simplest thing you'd imagine? The simplest thing would be to have all of the arbors described by a function with one name, like a Gaussian or a boxcar, you know, or a pillbox or something. So that way, if you're trying to wire up the brain, you don't want to have to worry about what kind of arbor you're looking for. You just have to know where is it and how big do I expect it to be, and go there, and then it'll all wire up just right probabilistically. The reason this work was related to some other work that I'm not talking about that had to do with scalable architectures. And we started, most of the data came from the literature, but these data that you're looking at here came from my lab. And most of it came from fish arbors. And the reason for using fish is the following. A fish never stops growing. It keeps growing until it dies. And as it grows, it continues to add more and more and more cells. It adds more retinal ganglion cells. It adds more photoreceptor cells, more bipolar cells. The arbor, the eye gets bigger, the retina gets bigger, more cells in it. The tectum gets bigger, more cells in that too. And so a place to study scale, but everyone believes it's the same circuit in all these cases. And in fact, in principle, you could study one fish through its whole life and do some sort of non-lethal imaging on it and actually study one organism over a long period of time. And so we studied fish for that reason, but then we used the arbors that we had gotten for that reason for other reasons for this. And so that's why there is a pretty big range, a little bit over an order of magnitude, of sizes of the arbor, because as the fish grows bigger, its arbors get bigger. The cell is the same, but the arbor grows. Like the retinal ganglion cells are there. The retinal ganglion cells in a fish arbor, that were originally made are in the middle, and you add new cells around the periphery, but the old cells just stay there for the fish's life, but they don't just stay there, they get bigger. Okay, so we were thinking we'd like to have one or maybe two or three, a small number of functions that describe these arbor density functions. So what we used then was, basically what we know is we believe there's some sort of arbor density function. It exists, number one. We'd like to figure out a way of deciding how many arbor density functions there are, how many different names to give to the functions. And so what we did is we devised a test that would determine if all of the arbors on a particular graph are described by the same function. And what you use for this is you use the properties of arbors, the properties of functions that are just scaled up, but scaled up continuously in the scale factor that says how big they are. So you have an arbor that's this big, you have an arbor that's that big, you have some parameter like the sigma that I put over there, that and the and the and the and the, the that the function depends continuously on that particular value as it goes up. Functions of this kind have been studied a lot. They're used in physics, and they're called self-similar functions. It's not, it's different from a self-similar structure, it's a self-similar function. So if you just use the properties of self-similar functions, you can derive a test to see if the data that you're looking at came from a data set that is described by the same density function. The test has two steps in it. In the first step, you plot the log of the arbor size, and the arbor size is sigma x times sigma y. That's the second moment normalized in the x direction, the second moment normalized in the y direction for the two-dimensional arbors. For a three-dimensional arbor, it would be sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. That's what you plot here. And over here, you plot the log of the observed mk. When you do that, if these arbors are all defined by a function with the same name, then the zeroth moment looks like that. This is the size of the arbor versus m sub zero. The size of the arbor versus m sub zero is the length of the arbor, so this is size versus length. And if things are self-similar, if things are defined or described by a self-similar function, they have to follow power laws. They have to. And so this does follow a power law. So on the log-log plot, it should fall on a straight line. And that straight line has some intercept over here and some slope. If you look at the next moment up, it'll go steeper like that, and the next moment up, it goes steeper like this. So every data point, every arbor gives a point here, one for each moment, like that. And if you have different size arbors, which we did because that's where the data came from, then you'll have another arbor that has data points over here. And if you have enough different sized arbors, they'll populate a line here. And if these are described by one function that has always the same name, then they have to fall on straight lines. And so you can test for that by various ways, like doing just a least squares. That's the first step, okay? Power laws. The second step is that it has to be, yeah?
Sorry, so could you maybe walk us through what would happen if this distribution were exactly that Gaussian?
We're
a Gaussian.
Yeah, I'm going to come back and do that in a minute. Yeah, these tests here are not tests for Gaussians. These tests are for all the same name for the function. Okay, so you do this, and the second thing is that you that it has to be, if it's one function, that the slope here, this is S sub k, is the slope of this for the kth moment. That S sub k has to equal k plus a. A is a constant, k is the moment order. And so what you do is you fit least squares lines to all these, and then you plot, and then you plot the slope here, S sub k versus the moment order, and that has to be a straight line with a slope of 1. And an intercept of A, whatever that is, and A doesn't, there's no way of knowing what A is in advance. I mean, you could make a theory to say it, but it's not obvious. Okay, so this is a test for any function at all. You can give me a function, and I can turn it into a function that scales continuously, and then I can apply this test to it, and the test will be fulfilled. What happens if you, so where does the specificity for the kind of function come in? The specificity comes in the pattern of intercepts over here. if you give me one function, I'll do this plot, it'll be a certain way. If you give me a second function, a different function, then the intercepts would be maybe here and here and there. So all the information about what the name of the function is comes from where the intercepts are, and whether or not one name does for everything, it depends on if these things fit. If you had two functions mixed in, two density functions mixed in, then the data would be smeared out, because you would have some of these data would be falling on lines with one intercept, some would be falling on lines with another intercept. So you'd have a bunch of different intercepts mixed in, and so you could tell, depending on how good your data are, you could tell if it's fit pretty well by a single function or if there have to be multiple ones. What we were expecting when we started this is that we'd do a bunch of things and we'd find some things fell along one line, other things fell along that line up there. And that we could tell that there were two different functions. Yeah.
So what do you mean by mixtures? So would an example be maybe a Gaussian distribution?
In a box, in a pill box.
Exponential?
An exponential, yeah. Right. Those would give different, or a pill box, or something that went like that, anything.
Pure exponential or a pure Gaussian?
Yes, if it were pure. But if half of your arbors had one density function and the other had one with a different name, then they wouldn't fall all on these same lines like this. Some would fall along this line and the others would fall along another line up there. I drew it bigger. But the data would be definitely smeared out a lot as you go along there. Okay. So, yes?
It seems to me like it must be harder to estimate the higher order moments. I mean, the higher you go, if you go.
No, you just tell the computer to do it.
No, but I mean, you need more data to get the error bars get bigger, I guess.
Yeah, they do. Right. You'll see in a second.
Okay.
Yeah, they get bigger. Okay, so here is the first step in testing for these fish arbors, if they are described by a function with one name. This is the zeroth moment, second, and if you care, I'll tell you why we didn't plot the first order, the odd number of moments here. There's a reason why, and we actually did do that, but it's beside the point. This is 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10th moment, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20. This is log to the base 10. These arbors, the biggest moments are 10 to the 80th power. These are big numbers. What you'll notice is the open circles are dendritic arbors, the squares are axonal arbors. They all fall pretty much on the same lines, and you can see that these things are well fitted by straight lines, just to look at it. These lines that are on here were just done in a dumb way. You just tell the program, give me the least squares fit. And then you take the slope of each one of these lines and you plot it, the slope versus the moment order, and you plot it up there. And the line that's drawn on there is a line with a slope of 1. And an intercept that's a small positive number down there. So that means that the scaling coefficient for the length, for the area versus length, is a number like 0.5. Okay, so what this says is that as far as we can see, there's no systematic deviation from this. And what we have also done is look at the distribution of points along this line. How do they spread? And both the axons and dendrites spread by according to a Gaussian. In other words, there's no hint of two peaks. And they're the same Gaussian on both sides. And the standard deviation is predicted from the standard deviation down here. So there's no, and what that means, by the way, is if a point falls above the line, it's a denser arbor. If it falls below the line, it's a sparser arbor, and that may be something that you'd think the nervous system might want to have control over, but it doesn't vary very much. Okay, so the conclusion for this first, this B and C here is that all of the fish arbors that we looked at, a couple hundred, axons and dendrites are fitted by the same density function, as far as we can tell, and it passes both tests for this self-similar function. Okay, now, what function, yes?
Sure, I missed something, but the odd moments vanish.
Yes, they do vanish. They all vanish, and they do vanish on average. So what we did, so we didn't throw that information away, actually, is we took the absolute value of that.
Oh, fine. Did you say fine? Sorry.
It's just so we had the, and they fall right in between. Nothing's different. And in fact, right here, all that line there is fitted with all, with even and odd. Okay. Now, what function is fitting these things? Well, the fact that it comes very close to being separable means maybe it's a Gaussian. There are other reasons for wanting to have a Gaussian. A Gaussian is a function that maximizes the entropy that you're, of your sampling. That means that you're sampling not any place in particular, but as broadly as you can over a prescribed region that's the size of the arbor. So you might want it to be a Gaussian. And but it can't be a Gaussian, a true Gaussian, because a true Gaussian goes to infinity, and an arbor has an edge on it. It doesn't go past that edge, and you can't have half branches or quarter branches out here, or have them dotted or something. It has to be a hard truncation at the edges. So
what do you mean by it maximizes the entropy? I mean, wouldn't the maximal entropy function just be a square pillbox, flat distribution?
No, not for a prescribed size. The maximum entropy is a Gaussian. If you specify that for the size is specifying the variance.
You specify it goes to zero at the boundary.
No, you don't have to do that. A Gaussian is a function. If you tell me what the variance is, and you tell me how big something is.
With a specified variance.
Yeah, with a specified variance, and the variance is the size. And there are reasons why you want to worry about the size. It has to do with signal to noise and being able to get best resolution. Okay, so. Using several different tests that I'm not going to tell you about unless you ask me, we decided that the Gaussian ought to have a standard deviation of very close the truncation point ought to be just about two standard deviations out. This line here is the fit of a this is the intercept here. So you measure the intercept of each one of these, extrapolated back to log zero, log one to zero. You calculate the intercepts back there, and then this line here is what a Gaussian would give you if it was two standard deviations, if it would truncate at two standard deviations. This line down here is what a pillbox would give you, and this line up here is what an arbor that was truncated at three standard deviations would be. And so if you had some arbors that were truncated at two, some at two and a half, then you would have a smear of things all in here. These error bars here are not standard errors of the mean or standard deviations. Those are 95% confidence limits. And so the data are, if you do it in a more conventional way, they'd be like this. They're quite a tight fit. Okay, so the conclusion then to this is that these fish arbors are fitted by one function, a Gaussian that's truncated at two standard deviations. Yeah?
Sorry, what about an exponential?
Exponential would be worse than a Gaussian.
Would be worse than a Gaussian.
would be worse than if you fit. You couldn't fit these with an exponential; it wouldn't fit well because if you have another function, it would go up like that. You don't have total. You can't just use. It's not an arbitrary fit. What you do is you take the function and then you have to truncate it at a particular place, and there are no free variables in there. You don't just get to fit anything. And so an exponential just would be easily detectable as different. A single exponential would be. Okay.
Because those lines are linear, isn't it true that you could take the intercept anywhere?
No, this isn't just kind of arbitrary. This is worked. There's a little theory worked out for what you would get for this. The reason for plotting these particular things that are here is because that's what you need to do to have it all come out neat. And then you have to have a unit, and that unit is the size of log zero, log one, zero. Yeah. Okay. So, what about three-dimensional arbors?
Before we go there, what about other cell types?
I'm just going to do that. Okay. These are just two cell types. This is the warm-up. This is the simple part because we had these data. They're simple cells. You don't have to worry about three dimensions. Everything is much simpler. So we were just trying it for this. We were amazed that the same function could be fitting two axons and dendrites. That I would not have suspected that. Okay. Now this is the same plot for three-dimensional arbors. We did not collect any of these data. They came from a site called neuromorpho.org. There are some problems with it, which we could discuss if you want. But these data come from approximately a dozen different laboratories who have submitted their data to their arbors done in NeuroLucida to neuromorpho.org. We just downloaded everything they had. We fitted everything that we downloaded. And we did exclude. There were some things that are there now that we excluded at the time because they were rotten quality, but they weren't there, so we didn't have to worry about it at the time. These are excitatory neurons from a bunch of different areas of cortex, inhibitory neurons from a bunch of different areas of cortex, all different kinds, inhibitory and excitatory neurons from hippocampus. The species are mouse, rat, cat, macaque, and human. There are a lot of species, and these fits are better than they look. The reason for that is there are over 1,000 data points on each line here, because there are over 1,000 arbors that we analyzed doing this. And most of the arbors are in the middle here, but those obscure each other, so you can't see how many data points there are there. And you can see the ones that are kind of out toward the edge. And so actually, this looks pretty good to me, but it's actually a little bit better than it looks. Okay, same thing. Least squares fits to all these, zeroth order up to the 20th, zeroth moment up to the 20th moment, fit least squares lines to them, get the slopes out, plot the slope versus the moment order, a line with a slope of 1 on there. And these pass the test for being all the same named function. Then you plot the intercept over here versus the moment order, and this is the fit for a Gaussian with a standard deviation, with a truncation at 2 standard deviations out. This is the 95% confidence limits, and this is a pillbox function. So, I mean, which is the same as a Gaussian that has very few standard deviations. And this is the fit of 1 standard deviation more. 2 standard deviation truncation, 3 standard deviation truncation. Okay, so what I can't remember what time I started and what time I should finish, David.
You started slightly after 2, so.
So I have maybe 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, that'll do it. Okay, so the conclusion then is that these arbors can all be adequately described by a Gaussian truncated at two standard deviations. Is that I mean, you may want to argue with me about it later, but are there questions about it? Okay, there are a bunch of questions that are left over. And I'm not gonna, and some of them I have answers to and some I don't. One of them is...
One question?
Hmm?
What's the simplest perturbation you could do to make it not look like this?
Oh, if you... If you look in the paper we published there are examples there, and if you take a Gaussian function, but you make its standard deviation a little more complicated, so it depends on something on standard deviation plus a constant or something like that, then you can get things that look exactly like Gaussians. They look exactly like what you'd expect, but when you do these plots, they don't work.
So Kokinji,
thank you for mentioning that. Excellent. Okay, so these lines here are just taken, literally taken, from the fish two-dimensional arbors. And there are not many Purkinje cells in the literature, but the half dozen or dozen of them are plotted here. There are no free parameters here. All you do is you take the data from the fish, and then you take the Purkinje cell data, and you plot it on the same axes, and you can see there's nothing adjusted, and it fits pretty well. What's more interesting is that in the other things, in the 3D things, there were pyramidal cells and inhibitory neurons from hippocampus grown in three dimensions. These things here are grown in culture, and so what you've done is you've taken what normally would be a three-dimensional arbor and you've constrained it to be in two dimensions, and when you do that, then it fits the same as a normal two-dimensional arbor. So this suggests that whatever the mechanisms are for generating a three-dimensional arbor and a two-dimensional arbor, they're not fundamentally different. They're doing the same sort of thing, but that growing in three dimensions just relaxes some constraint and gives you and puts you on the right grass for three dimensions. Okay. Yeah.
You talk about the dimensionality has to be two or three.
Yeah.
These are arbors. They can have fractional dimensions.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you have to determine dimensionality?
Yes, so right.
So assuming it?
So when I talk about two and three, I'm talking about the embedding dimension that you put them in. So the fish arbors are flat, and you embed them in two dimensions, and you can describe them. Same for Purkinje cells. For these other ones, you couldn't embed them in two. You have to embed them in three. You can ask, is there a fractal dimension of these? And the answer is, you can't be sure, but I wouldn't believe it. And that is that the way that you normally look at fractal dimensions is you do this box counting method or something like that. And you do a plot, and then what you do is, if you want to publish a paper, you find the region over which that's a straight line and put it there. But they aren't really straight lines, and so I wouldn't be able to claim that they had a fractal dimension well defined, but they might. I don't know. We haven't looked. I have looked at that, but not enormously. Yeah. But but I'm talking about the embedding dimension. Okay. So. What are the questions? Yes?
Just, I'm still a little surprised that they all fit that.
Of course you are. Me too. You can imagine how surprised I was when I did that first plot and the axons and the dendrites were falling on the same line. I mean, Jesus, look at that.
So there's these retinal ganglion cells that they discovered recently from Josh Sain's lab.
Yeah.
They're called arrow cells.
Sure. I don't know. They tend to be pushed over to one side, and I haven't looked at any of them yet. They have a bunch of them, so we could probably get a hold of them. But it's the center of mass of the arbor that you're looking at. And so what you do is you look at the center of mass there, and then you'd see where the arbor was. And I don't know if they would fit a Gaussian or not. I'm not claiming that every arbor in the world does this. I'm just saying all the ones we've ever looked at did it.
This is kind of what I guess it would make me a lot happier if cells that don't look Gaussian don't fit this.
Yes, yeah, me too.
And do you have any examples of that?
Yeah, okay, so we've looked at rivers, and rivers in California, river patterns in California don't fit, but that's because a lot of it is human engineered. Looked at wing venation patterns in insects. They are self-similar, but they don't fit a Gaussian. They fit a boxcar, because the goal of the wing vanes is to give aerodynamic stability to the wing, and so they have to be spread over the wing kind of uniformly.
So you have examples of things?
Yeah, that don't. Yeah, nothing. Yes.
How sensitive is this result to how you cut out the arms?
We actually didn't cut the arbors at all. We just took whatever we got.
The whole thing, like you mentioned earlier.
No, we the people who drew the arbors in the first place said apical dendrite axonal. We just fitted it. And so but most of them probably were not layer 5B pyramidal cells. Because they probably were not mostly those ones that go up, have a long straight part and like that. So we actually didn't do anything. We just took them. But we, in principle, we would if we thought there was a reason to. We just didn't bother. Okay, what are the questions? One question is, this thing here says that the length of the arbor is proportional to the area of the arbor to a power. Why does it have that power? It's 0.5, say. Why does it have 0.5 rather than 0.7 or something like that? A good theory would have to say that. A good theory would also have to say what the prefactor is. You have to be a reason for that. You'd have to know why the arbors are truncated at 2 standard deviations, and you would have to know why they were fitted by a Gaussian, why the brain wants to have Gaussians, and you also want to know how it achieves a Gaussian. What are the pattern formation mechanisms that give you a Gaussian? Okay, all of those things are things that we have worked on some, and are still working on, but I'm going to tell you what I was doing the first part of this summer, because I thought it was the most important thing to do, which is to ask the question, what are the properties of the branching patterns of arbors that guarantee that you're going to get a Gaussian here? How do they do it? Okay, and that's what I'm going to tell you about in the next 15 minutes. Okay, I guess I'm going to start with some data. I have only done this with the fish arbors, and actually only the fish dendritic arbors so far. So I'm going to show you the data from that that's relevant. Okay, here is an arbor. It starts here at the cell body. It goes up. It branches like this. It branches like this, and like this, and then maybe it branches like that. And so this is a branch. It's from the start of the arbor, which is a cell body or a branch point, and it goes up to the next point, branch point up here. So this is a termination here. There are two kinds of terminations. You can either terminate in a bifurcation, or you can terminate in a tip. And it turns out that what I'm going to need to know later is, what are the chances of each of these two things? For a real arbor, what do they do? And this is not the right data for doing this, but it does it okay. And that is, this is the density from the arbor origin, just normalized up to 1. And this is the density of branch points and of branch points and bifurcations. The crosses are bifurcations, the zeros are branch points, and this is just a whole bunch of different retinal ganglion cell arbors. Yeah?
This bird's flight distance or distance along the arbor?
See?
It says bird's flight distance or distance along the arbor?
This is radial distance. Radial distance from the, but there are a whole population of arbors here. And so what you can see is that the branch point number and the bifurcation number and the tip number, the density of those in every annulus going out are about the same. And this line happens to be a slope of -2 on a log-log plot. Okay, so this is not right. But this is what I had, and I have to do it better. But this makes it look like that the chances of a termination being a branch point or a tip are equal over the whole range of the arbor, and that it's 50-50. Okay, that's the first thing. This is the number of branches in about 1,000 arbors versus the branch length. This is the density function, basically. And there's a dead length, so they don't branch instantly. But they all the branches are fitted pretty well with a single exponential whose mean is about 10 microns. So, I've done some more with this. The problem is that you have to rewrite programs to do things in a better way than this was done. And you'd like to know where in the arbor was each branch taken. These were branches from different sizes. These are branches from all arbors, all different sizes, small, large, all branches close to the cell body, far from the cell body. The fact that they fit a single exponential makes you think that there's pretty homogeneous. And I have done, I've started to do some other things now to do it properly, which is to keep track of what the distribution of branches at different distances, or what the mean branch is a function of distance from the arbor. Yeah.
So what happens if you separate your population by cell type?
These are all one cell type. These are all retinal ganglion cells from fish, and they were chosen because I didn't want to have to worry about separating them. This is just the start.
So you want to say that as you go out, there's now a choice that you have to make. Either become a branch point or terminate?
What this says is that there's an exponential distribution of branch lengths. That means this is how long they go before they terminate. The first one said that if they do terminate, they terminate either in a tip or a bifurcation, and that the ratio of those two is constant over the whole arbor, and it's about a half.
And so, in terms of what goes on inside the cell, are there similar kinds of things happening with the cytoskeleton at a branch point versus a termination?
No, because the microtubules, for example, get split up between the two. In the other case, they just end.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, this is just a scripty. This is not okay. So I have not. This is. I'm telling you about work I did this summer. Work Joe did in earlier was he made a computer model that does all this. And basically, the computer model is what you would expect from the work Steve did with Chris Neal. That is, that they send out a trial branch. If they can make enough synapses, they stabilize. If not, they withdraw and try again. That's basically it. Okay. This is all the experimental data I have. How would you formalize this? The fact that all branches are fitted by a single exponential makes you think that there is, and it's an exponential, a little bit of dead time, don't worry about that, that it's described by a Poisson process, and that every branch is described by the same Poisson process, as a homogeneous Poisson process, and that the branches are independent. The Poisson parameter is the same for all branches, and they're independent. Okay, if you, that's principle number one. It's not actually a Poisson process, it's actually what you call a semi-Markov process, because you start fresh each time you've had a branch. Okay, principle number two is, that this tells you how the branches terminate. Principle number two is that tip probability to bifurcation probability is equal to, is a constant. And it happens to be, this is one, it happens to be one. It doesn't have to be one, nothing matters about that.
Chuck, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What's Poisson?
The not how far it goes from the cell body, but if you march along the dendrite, how far does it go? It might be curved in space, but you don't care about that. You just march along it. So you're basically turning.
The length is Poisson, you say.
Yeah, it's an exponential.
Okay.
That's what this says here.
From basal, from the cell body all the way to the.
No, that's right. No matter where you look, if you have a termination and then you have a branch, the branch of that is an exponential described by one length constant, and that would be generated by a technically semi-Markov process that started here and then went until it terminated next, and then started again and went again.
Didn't it just say that that the probability of either terminating in one of those two processes is a constant as a function of the length? It's just
yeah, it is. The probability of terminating is the same, independent of independent where it is. But the probability that it terminates by a tip versus a bifurcation is constant over the whole arbor. Okay, these are data. They're not great data. I have some better data actually, but I'm just starting to analyze it now. Yeah.
Sorry, I think I just missed. So did you say path length?
Yes. Okay. Now that's a very important thing, because what I'm doing in this is, I'm taking an arbor that looks like this, and I am collapsing it down to one dimension. So it's this, and then there are two right on top of each other, and then there are three right on top of each other, depending on where the tips and everything are. So I'm first of all, step one is to describe the arbor as a one-dimensional thing, not worrying how it's distributed in space. And then the third principle is that what you do is you assume that the arbor is doing its best to spread out. Now, what would it have to do the best to spread out? So here is an annulus close to the arbor, and you have a certain amount of length to spread over this. So I call the distance along the arbor S, and the radial distance R. And I'm just treating circular arbors. I'm not worrying about the ones that are extended in one direction or the other. And if you have a certain amount of arbor length and you want to spread it over this, you can use it partly for radial distance and partly for lateral distance. If you have a bigger annulus out here, then because you have a bigger way around, you can't make this annulus as thick if you want to cover it the same amount. I'm not going to talk about it, but what it works out is that S is equal to R squared over 2. If that's true, if you take this one-dimensional arbor and then you spread it out over space, that's what you have to do. You can sort of see it. Okay, so Things are always taking longer than I thought. How much longer do you want me to talk?
Like the side on the car, the objects are closer
than. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Time, it's like my right hand rear view mirror. Time is always closer than.
How about if we take 5 minutes?
Okay, 5 minutes. Okay. Yeah. So basically, what you do is the following. You say, here is a chain of branches. Of length, this is called length 0, 1, 2, 3. And you can write down the probability that a chain of length 3 is a certain length. And basically, it's just a convolution of it's a fourfold convolution of the of exponentials. Okay, and the answer is that f of s and k is equal to e to the minus s o to the kth power over k factorial. If you measure in units of length constants. Okay, that's the first thing. So this tells you what the chances are that you're going to have a chain of branches, 0 added on, 1 added on, 2 added on, 3 added on, up to infinity. Then you can take this and you can take this tip versus bifurcation probability, and you can write down the probability that if you look at a certain distance, you're going to find a branch there. And so you can call that, and it turns out that after you go a few steps out, that you can neglect things, so you can just sum up to infinity, and so then you can calculate phi of s, which is the probability for the whole arbor stretched out in one dimension that you're going to find that you're going to touch a branch if you go out there. And it turns out that this is, and you have to sum it up, and you have to keep track of how you have to keep track of the fact that it has to sum up to one to be a probability, and that you have to make use of this tip versus bifurcation probability, and if you do that, you end up with something that is a half e to the minus s over 2. S over 2. In other words, when you do that sum, you have a whole bunch of terms here. Those terms add up to something that is an exponential with a positive exponent, and you subtract that from this, and you end up with this. Okay, now what you do is you say g of r dr, this is in three dimensions, where you have r as a function of s, is equal to phi of s ds. This is the way you change variables with probability densities. And if you plug rule number 3 into this and use that, in other words, you have just a plain exponential here, then what you get is a Gaussian that has been summed around all the annuli, which is the right thing for this. Okay, so that's the, I give you a sketch of what you do. And if you do this, then you get a Gaussian. And so it says that these three properties right here, which are experimentally based, I didn't postulate them, I looked at the experimental data, these three properties guarantee that you're going to have a Gaussian density function. The trouble is that exactly these same three properties cannot be true for 3D, because in 3D you would have to have that S is proportional to R cubed, and if you got the same thing over here, you wouldn't get a Gaussian anymore. So there has to be something that's different. What could be different? It could be that the Poisson process is no longer a homogeneous Poisson process, but it's an inhomogeneous Poisson process. That the chances of termination depend on how far out you go. That would be wonderful, because you can turn any inhomogeneous Poisson process into a homogeneous Poisson process by a change of variable. Another possibility is that if the tip probability versus the bifurcation probability is equal, that's what the data said. But as long as it doesn't change over position in the arbor, then everything all works for the 2D arbors. So it would have to be that the branching probability, the bifurcation probability versus the tip probability changes you went out. Okay, so what I'm doing now, what I started doing right before my summer ended, was writing the programs that I have to write to find out exactly what these things are happening. Why is that hard? It's because the file structure that everybody puts these things in is a very compact file structure, and that means that it's full of special cases. You have to deal with so many special cases, it drives you crazy. And so I have done it sort of, and when I do it sort of, I find that this is still true, and that the mean branch length does not depend on where you are in the arbor. And I've also found that the bifurcation versus done not with radial distance like we did before, but with linear distance along as you march along the arbor, that if you do that, then this ratio here is independent of position in the arbor. So that's been done approximately right, except I've only done on 2 arbors so far. And that was just 2 to try things out. And so now I have to go back, work out, get the, I'm going to just change the file structure. I'm going to translate the standard file structure into one that's easier for me to do business with, and find out what changes in the 3D arbors and see if it works. Okay, so this is quite different because I'm not emphasizing differences between things. I'm emphasizing all the things that are the same. Which is better? You can't say. You have to do both.
And it's all kinds.
It's all kinds, right? No, and I'm a great fan of the work that Steve is doing and Clay is doing and Winfrey is doing, and I think it's giving us information. Misha's going to be talking. I don't know what Misha's going to talk about, but it's going to be giving us information. We're not going to have any other way, and it's going to be fantastic. You can't do without it. On the other hand, it doesn't hurt to start trying to plan ahead and finding some principles that govern the neural circuits. And that's what I've tried to describe today. Okay, great, thank you. Yes?
Gave a convincing argument for a Gaussian, but lots of things result in Gaussians. More remarkable to me seems the fact that they're all cut off at 2 standard deviations.
Yeah.
Do you have any understanding of why that should
Yeah. Okay, so if you take a retina, and a one-dimensional retina, and you put a bunch of receptive fields, which are these arbors like that, and you put a point of light up here, and you move the point of light, and you want to be able to maximize your ability to tell where the light is with the fewest number of cells, you want to have them spaced at 2 standard deviations. Now that's not exactly the right thing, because these are not spaced at 2 standard deviations. They're spaced at something different because they're cut off, and I have to go back and what I did before is things that just went way out, but I have to go back and do it for truncated arbors. So I think that's why it's the way that you maximize your resolution. You're able to guess where a point of light is in the environment when it's in overlapping fields. Okay.
I got more of a thought. And
quick cookies.
Cookies.